This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our guest, Marissa Tomei, won an Oscar when she was 28 for her role as a brash, dolled-up, Brooklyn-born ordo buff in the film My Cousin Vinny. She later earned Oscar nominations for dramatic roles in the films In the Bedroom and The Wrestler. She co-stars in the new movie Cyrus with John C. Reilly. He plays a divorced man who, after meeting Tomei, thinks he's finally found the perfect woman. To learn more about her, he follows her home, where he discovers she lives with her 21-year-old son, Cyrus, with whom she's unusually close. Cyrus is played by Jonah Hill. The son feels displaced and threatened by his mother's new boyfriend. The boyfriend is uncomfortable with how close the son is to his mother, but neither is letting on. In this scene, just after that first meeting between the son and the boyfriend, John C. Reilly decides to stay over at Marissa Tomei's place for the first time. Reilly and Tomei are talking in her bedroom.
I really appreciated what you were expressing in the kitchen, and I appreciate how open you were. I love that about you, and I'm sorry that I wasn't as open about my boy.
No, that's fine. It's your prerogative not to say that stuff. You know, it's private. We just met.
He's very mature, as you can see, in a lot of ways. And he really pushes me. But in other ways, he's not come into himself yet. This is a very sudden... You are very sudden. Yeah. And I haven't had a man over and to stay overnight since Cyrus was born.
But to tell you the truth, you didn't have me over. I stalked you over.
Yeah, you gave it a little. Thanks for talking to me. No, we leave the door open.
Oh, I was just going to take my pants off.
We just always leave the door open.
Okay.
Marissa Tomei spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Marissa Tomei, welcome to Fresh Air. This new film, Cyrus, is really interesting both because of the plot. You play a woman with a son with an extraordinarily close relationship, an adult son, a 21-year-old son, I guess. But it's also interesting because it's directed by Mark and Jay Duplass, who are – I guess this is their first bigger budget mainstream film. But they're known for a really unique way of making films. You want to kind of describe their technique as you experienced it?
Yes, they work very uniquely from anyone that I've worked with. They write together, direct together. They work really intimately with everybody on the crew, which is also a small crew, and with the actors. And they use a lot of improvisation. And they told me in our first meeting, one of the unique things about them was that they say, "We don't know a lot." So we'll come to a scene, probably, Marissa, and we'll just say, "We don't know what we're going to do with this scene," and we'll all work it out together. And that's when they had my heart, and that's when they really captured me, because I know that saying "I don't know" is really a really creative place. And when people really trust themselves enough to say "I don't know," that's when you really start get cooking.
Have you done a lot of improvisation before?
You know, intermittently in different scenes, like finessing dialogue. but in this case, it was like that was the mandate ahead of time. So even though the script, they wrote a great script. It wasn't just a blueprint. It was a finely tuned script with great characters and great dialogue. And many days, Jonah Hill and John C. Reilly and I said, "We love the script. Can't we just use the script today?" And they prefer to break it apart. And, well, let's just see what comes out. Let's play with it. And sometimes we circle back to what we have in the script. Other times we tossed it out.
This is about, of course, an odd kind of love triangle in a way, in which you're the fulcrum. You have this relationship with John C. Reilly, but you have this very, very close relationship with your son, played by Jonah Hill, who I guess is 21, right, in the script.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah,
you know, it's a relationship that's so close, could be regarded as unhealthy. How did you get a feel for that relationship, making it real?
You know, because you're going to play this person, you can't judge them ahead of time. So, like, I wasn't reading it going, oh, this is really unhealthy, and how am I going to play this unhealthy person? It's like seeing it through the lens of why she thinks that everything she's doing is right. So I approached it in the sense of they're great friends. They have a great relationship. They truly enjoy each other's company. And they've lived a very artsy and more bohemian kind of life. And they laugh well together. So I just saw it as more of a, just really great friends. You know, and that part of it is really healthy. And, you know, the
right.
downside with her is it's just he needs to get out of the house. Find out.
Needs to find his life. Right, mm-hmm. right. You know, in the production notes to the film, one of the directors, Mark Duplass, says, we don't write female characters all that well. And Marissa did a great job of fixing that stuff up for us. And I think his brother said you really stood up for the character. Do you know what they mean?
I don't know exactly what they mean, but I know that I was concerned that she would be a bit of a patsy because the rivalry between her son and her lover is really palpable. And her son is kind of a pain in the arse a lot of the times. So how come she's not seeing this? So we have to make sure it's not in front of her face. And we have to make sure that she's intelligent and leading with her heart. And that's okay to make some mistakes when you're leading with your heart. But she can't be played for a fool. So we discussed that a lot. And they really watched out for her.
If you're just joining us, our guest is actress Marissa Tomei. She has won an Academy Award and been nominated for others. She's starring with John C. Reilly and Jonah Hill in the new film Cyrus. Well, I wanted to talk about The Wrestler, which earned you an Academy Award nomination, I guess, last year. You star with Mickey Rourke, who plays an aging wrestler, and you're a stripper in a club. And I read that when you were preparing for this role that you went and talked to strippers at clubs in New Jersey. I'm just, what did you ask them? What did you learn?
I mean, more in LA. I okay. hung out with a bunch of girls and somewhat in New York. What did I learn? You know what I learned? It's all true. Guys are pretty simple at the end of the day. you know, I also thought that her, that character really mirrored, I mean, we didn't really explore it that much in that film, but what I learned from them was that what Mickey's character was going through in terms of his body being his job and it starting to fail him and some of the things he had to do physically taking its toll. Like, honestly, just those heels alone really cause a lot of backaches for those girls. And we didn't really get into that, but the stuff that Mickey's character is going through, it's the same that she's going through too, putting her full body on the line every day.
Right,
to survive.
And approaching at some point the notion that, you know, it's not going to
be... Gotta hang it up.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's not going to work
yeah.
anymore.
Yeah.
Well, let's
yeah.
listen to a scene. This is yeah. well into the film, and this is at a moment where Mickey Rourke, the wrestler, has come to the club where you're working. And, of course, he's infatuated with your character. And he's just giving you a thank you card because you had helped him pick out some clothes for his estranged daughter. And let's listen to some of the interaction here.
Okay. Thank you. That's very sweet.
Hey, thank you. I mean, come on, baby. You saved my ass. What?
I can't do this.
Can't do what?
This.
I thought we had a little something going on here.
No. Well, I think you're awesome. I think that you're a great guy.
So what's the problem?
You think that I'm like this stripper, and I'm not. I'm a mom. I have responsibilities. I have a son. Anyway, you don't want that luggage, so.
What if I do?
I can't go there.
What about the other day?
It was a mistake.
It didn't feel like a mistake to me.
The club in the real world, they don't mix.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, I think that's a lot of bull because I think you still feel something.
You're a customer, okay? You're a customer. I don't go out with customers. You got it?
And that's our guest, Marissa Tomei, and Mickey Rourke in the film The Wrestler. You know, the other thing about, you know, this role for you is there's just you have to appear nude a lot. I read that earlier in your career you would use a body double in scenes like that. Was it – I don't know. What was it like? Was it hard to get comfortable with showing so much of yourself in this role?
Well, in reference to the earlier on, I think I just really had to do – I never really had to do anything like this. I think there was like one thing in Slums of Beverly Hills, like a little shower moment or whatever. And that was just, I was a young girl and definitely wanted to feel, you know, super protected. In this, I had already done Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. So that kind of broke me in. that broke the ice. And that was with Sidney Lumet directing. And so, and he was very paternal and protective, and I wasn't sure if it was the right thing even to do. I just really, career-wise, like, is this cool for me to be doing right now at this stage? But I really, really wanted to work with Lumet and Phil Hoffman and Ethan Hawke, and so, you know, I took the chance, and then it was fine. And so after I had done that, it was really kind of, oh, again? Next year? Really? I couldn't believe that those two things were on the heels of each other, and it looked like some kind of weird plan that I had, but it was just happenstance.
And when you said you wondered if it's the right thing to do at kind of at this time in your career, was it?
Yeah, well, it turned out fine. Both of those movies are really good movies. On a personal level, I'm really happy that I did them and got to work with those people. And they were very well received, so that's always a bonus.
Well, we have to talk about My Cousin Vinny, which you won the Oscar for, this terrific film where you are Joe Pesci's fiancé, he, the new Brooklyn lawyer, heading down to get his cousins out of a jam in Alabama. They've gotten involved in a murder case that they weren't really involved in. And we're going to listen to this well-known scene in which you have taken the stand to crack the case because of your understanding of cars and car mechanics. And this is a moment where the prosecutor, played by Lane Smith, tries to disqualify you by questioning your expertise.
Can you tell me what would the correct ignition timing be on a 1955 Bel Air Chevrolet with a 327 cubic inch engine and a full barrel carburetor?
It's a question.
Does that mean that you can't answer it?
It's a question. It's impossible to answer.
Impossible because you don't know the answer.
Nobody could answer that question.
Your Honor, I move to disqualify Ms. Vito as an expert witness.
Can you answer the question?
No, it is a trick question.
Why is it a trick question?
Watch this.
Because Chevy didn't make a 327 in 55. The 327 didn't come out till 62. And it wasn't offered in the Bel Air with a four-barrel carb till 64. However, in 1964, the correct ignition timing would be 4 degrees before top dead center.
Well, she's acceptable, Your Honor.
That was my guest, Marissa Tomei, in the film My Cousin Vinny. You also heard some of Joe Pesci and Fred Gwynne and, of course, Lane Smith, the prosecutor. You know, Marissa Tomei, you grew up in Brooklyn. Did you ever sound like this character, Mona Lisa Vito?
I don't think that extreme, but I could be wrong. My mom is, she was an English teacher, and she was on my butt about that kind of thing and correcting my speech from a young age.
Well, this was, of course, huge for you. I mean, you got, you know, the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress. How did that affect the roles that you were offered afterward?
I was offered a lot of comedies, which was great. And I didn't really know how to pick and choose. And I knew that I was most interested in a variety of characters. And it wasn't in contrast to, oh, now I don't want to play this because I have to get away from this image. It was more, what else is out there? I'm curious.
Right. I thought I'd read that you had done Shakespeare in New York after this.
I did Shakespeare in the Park right after that, yeah.
Right. But it wasn't like you felt you had to retreat into something that was more serious.
No. I mean, if anything, if there was any retreats, it was just going back to the theater again and again, because movie making was foreign to me and not where I felt particularly safe and really not as satisfied. And so I just kept doing plays like I had always done.
It's interesting. You said you didn't feel as safe on a movie set. In the movie, you can get as many takes as you want to get it right. On the stage, you're you're right there with, in front of the audience.
For me, and certainly at that time, being in a rehearsal room with just a handful of people and having time to work on the script together, and mostly I'm talking about in a social way, get to know your fellow artists and get to know each other in a kind of more relaxed way. But I just felt better in the theater.
Well, there's another moment in your career that we have to talk about, and I want to introduce this with a clip, and it's actually not of you, but more about you. Let's listen.
Let me ask you something. You ever hear of Marissa Tomei?
The actress?
Yeah, she's something, isn't she?
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, Katie, Elaine's friend?
Yeah?
She happens to be very good friends with her.
Marissa Tomei?
Mm-hmm.
How does she know Marissa Tomei?
I don't know. I didn't ask.
You didn't ask how she knows Marissa Tomei?
Not the point.
All right.
Can I finish?
Go ahead. Seems like a reasonable question. That's all I'm saying. I would have asked
her. All right. So she said that she could have fixed me up with her.
What do you mean could have?
Well, you know, if I wasn't engaged.
Oh.
Could have fixed me up with Marissa Tomei. She said I was just her type.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. You know the odds of me being anyone's type? I have never been anyone's type. But apparently, this Marissa Tomei loves funny, quirky, bold men.
You know, she won an Academy Award.
Like, I don't know that. My cousin Vinny, I love that.
And that, of course, is from the series Seinfeld, Jerry Seinfeld and Jason Alexander talking about our guest, Marissa Tomei. I don't know if you are sick of hearing about this or not. you obviously, I assume that they talked about this whole plot line with you before they wrote the scripts, right?
No.
No?
They just called and asked if I wanted to, you know, come and be a guest on their show. And then later I said, well, why did you even choose me? And they just said, we like the rhythm of your name. It really had nothing to do with me. We like saying your name, Marissa Tomei.
So that was it, Marissa Tomei?
Yeah. And well, and the bit that you just played, I really heard that. They just really used it as a, you know, a comic vehicle. Yeah.
Right.
Comic rhythm. Yeah.
Well, did you know that the plot line was that George Costanza would have a shot at you because you love funny, quirky, bald men?
I didn't know, but a lot of funny, quirky, bald men are happy because they're always talking to me about it.
Oh, really? Do people come up to you?
Yeah.
Well, I got to ask, what do you think of funny, quirky, bald men?
I set myself up, didn't I? I guess they're one of my types. I don't think I have a type.
All right, guys, you still have a shot. And for folks who don't watch the show or may not remember, what happens, of course, is that George is engaged, and because a friend knows Marissa Tomei, he eventually arranges a meeting, and it goes terrifically, and you just love him because he's a funny, quirky, bald guy, and then he finally reveals that indeed he's engaged, and you slug him and walk off. You got into acting early. If I know the story right, dropped out of college and quickly got a role on As the World Turns, the soap opera. Is that right?
I actually I had a line or two in Flamingo Kid,
right.
The Matt Dillon movie that Gary Marshall directed, and I was just auditioning through backstage the trade newspaper, the general audition calls, and I just happened to get that job. So even though I was in school and the Flamingo Kid thing was during the summer, I didn't know how many opportunities I might or might not have. So I talked with my parents about it, and my mom said, stay in school. My father said, take this chance. And so I took the chance.
What was your character like? Do you remember?
She was kind of a nut job. I think she was just really like an introverted, kind of perverse, forlorn character. Finally, someone in the town befriended me, a girl my age, and then I wound up falling in love with her father and like ruining his wedding. And it was kind of bizarre. I didn't stay on that show very long. I was supposed to stay longer and wound up getting fired from that. But
you got fired? What happened?
I mean, no scandal happened. I was really actually happy to leave because I wasn't happy on that show I mean, everyone was really kind to me and it was a good job, but I was lonely. All my friends were at school and I was just getting my feet wet in Manhattan. Nothing awful happened, but I was a little depressed.
But it worked. I mean, you got more work and made your way into films. You want to keep coming back to theater, right? And you still do.
Yes. Yeah. I did Top Girls last year on Broadway.
Well, Marissa Tomei, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you.
Marissa Tomei spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. She stars in the new movie Cyrus. You can see clips from the film on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our film critic David Edelstein called Winter's Bone the year's most stirring film. Winter's Bone won the Grand Jury Prize for Drama at this year's Sundance Film Festival. My guest is the director of the film, Deborah Granick, and the author of the novel that it's based on, Daniel Woodrell. Winter's Bone is set in the Ozarks, in a poor community where people have turned to cooking meth to make a living. The main character, Ree Dolly, played by Jennifer Lawrence, is a 17-year-old girl who's taking care of her two young siblings because her mother is mentally ill and her father, who cooks meth, has gone missing. After being arrested and putting the family home up for his bail bond, he disappears. Unless Ree finds him, she will lose the family's home and have nowhere to go. To find out where her father might be, she goes to the homes of relatives and other people her father knows, most of whom are also in the meth business. They're not interested in talking. In this scene, Ree is looking for Thump Milton, the leader of this meth underworld. As she approaches Thump's house, she's met by his wife, played by Dale Dickey.
You got the wrong place, I expect. Who might you be?
I'm Ree. My dad's Jessup Dolly.
You ain't here for trouble, are you?
No, ma'am.
Because one of my nephews is Buster Leroy, and didn't he shoot your daddy one time?
Yes. That ain't got nothing to do with me. They settled that themselves, I think.
Shooting him likely settled it. What is it you want?
I got a real bad need to talk with Thump.
And he ain't got no need to talk to you.
But I need to. I really, really got to, ma'am, please. Some of our blood at least is the same. Ain't that supposed to mean something? Isn't that what is always said?
Ain't you got no men could do this?
No, ma'am, I don't.
You go wait in the yard somewhere by that coop, and I'll tell Thump you're here.
That's a scene from Winter's Bone, the movie adaptation by Deborah Granick of Daniel Woodrell's novel. Deborah Granick, Daniel Woodrell, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, the man that Ree, the character in that scene, is trying to see Thump. Daniel Woodrell, in your novel, Winter's Bone, you describe him as having a face that's a monument of Ozark stone with juts and angles and cold-shaded parts the sun never touched. His voice held raised hammers and long shadows. It's a man I don't want to meet. now that we heard a scene from the film, Daniel Woodrell, let me ask you to do a short reading from the book that the movie's adapted from. And this is another scene in which Ree is trying to find out what happened to her father now that he's skipped bail. And in this scene, she goes to see her father's brother. Would you read that scene for us?
Sure. What's this all about, anyhow? I got to find Dad and make sure he shows in court. That's a man's personal choice, little girl. That's not something you ought to be butting your smarty nose into. Show or don't show, that choice is up to the one that's going to jail to make, not you. Uncle Teardrop was Jessup's elder and had been a crank chef longer, but he'd had a lab go wrong and it had eaten the left ear off his head and burned a savage, melted scar down his neck to the middle of his back. There wasn't enough ear nub remaining to hang sunglasses on. The hair around the ear was gone, too, and the scar on his neck showed above his collar. Three blue teardrops done in jailhouse ink fell in a row from the corner of the eye on his scarred side. Folks said the teardrops meant he'd three times done grisly prison deeds that needed doing but didn't need to be gabbed about. They said the teardrops told you everything you had to know about the man, and the lost ear just repeated it. He generally tried to sit with his melted side to the wall.
That's Daniel Woodrell reading from his novel Winter's Bone, which is adapted to the new film of the same name by Deborah Granick. Deborah, why did you want to adapt this book? How did you first discover it?
We were lucky to receive a copy of the book before publication, and Anne Rossellini, who made the film with me, we had been looking for a very long time for a female protagonist that we could recognize very readily as being someone that would shine out on screen. And this was a very irresistible book to us, and the story was one that seemed that it would adapt very well the way that Daniel had constructed it. So it was it was the rich descriptions of the area, and it was also the very, very tight structure.
Did you ask Daniel Woodrell for his help in showing you that part of the country, the Ozarks?
Most definitely. He got a call from me and Anne. It was probably at that point quite out of the blue, and we asked if we could come down to his neck of the woods. And we did meet with him and his wife, and they proceeded to hook us up with a couple very important first interviews and first veins to certain kinds of information and also physical places.
Daniel, what are some of the things you most wanted Deborah to know about your area that you drew on for the novel and you felt that she needed to understand?
Well, it's been a way of life for a long time. To me, the Ozarks was more or less settled by people who largely wanted to be left alone originally. And there's still just a strong thread of that running through a lot of the people who've been here a while, this sense of privacy and don't ask too many questions about other people's business. And there's so much physical beauty, and yet it's always been difficult to make a living in the Ozarks. So there's a lot of the attendant poverty that goes along with that, and yet it's in such a beautiful setting that I really wanted her to appreciate that.
Deborah, what struck you most that you hadn't seen before?
I feel like I hadn't seen a variety of hand-built houses. That was not familiar to me, or houses that may have had one part built from another form of housing, be it a form of trailer or a kit house, and then additions or small add-ons, very much built as needed or as could be afforded. So the texture of people's homes were extremely rich and diverse. I feel like I thought maybe it was lore and cliche or just a fantasy that maybe other people in the country have of mountain regions that music would be alive and well, and I found that to be, like, absolutely factually true, and that wowed me. I feel like I thought maybe that would be only relegated to certain kind of performances or places where you would pay for music, and I found it was very different, that it was very much incorporated into life.
Did you decide to shoot in actual homes as opposed to
a set?
Mm-hmm.
We did choose to shoot in actual homes. It would have been very difficult feat, and probably with very little fruit, to like try to imitate those homes or build a set that replicates it. Instead, we did come to believe that the only way that we would get the film just jammed with visual detail that was very precise and very much from those coordinates where we were filming was to actually go the full tilt and say, could we over time gain access to collaborate with certain families and then work on their properties, film, and that in the end meant like basically from A to Z. It was people's vehicles, their clothing, objects in their home, and eventually in one case it ended up being the daughter of the family who ended up playing Ree's younger sister.
So you just cast the girl who lived in the house?
In the end we did. She ended up being such an integral part of the crew and the preparation for the film. As we auditioned boys, the role was written for a boy. The novel has Ree having two boy siblings. And we auditioned and we looked and we searched and we came close a couple times and they just didn't quite seem to feel like they could be from that place. But Ashley did, every time we had a rehearsal. She would be caught in the videotape, and I would say, she really reads like she's, you know, she is from here. She's working.
Daniel Woodrell, the missing father in your novel, Winter's Bone, cooks crank, and everyone in the extended family seems to be involved in the business. Why did you want to write about characters who cook and sell meth?
Well, it's been a pretty widespread issue around here for the last 15 or 20 years, I suppose. And from my own house, I could throw a rock and hit meth cook right now. And it's just pretty ingrained, and it's a way to make some quick, easy money. You don't really have to be a master scientist to cook it or anything. And you can turn a quick profit. And it's just, for whatever reason, it really took hold here, perhaps earlier and more strongly than it did in many other parts of the country.
How has it changed your area?
Well, there's been a lot of criminal activity associated with it, and that anybody who's seen people before they started it and then after they'd been doing it hard for a couple of years can see the physical toll is often pretty drastic. And in my own neighborhood, at one point we had a number of people nearby who were engaged, and when they've been using crank for a few days in a row, you don't know what they might do. So, and all manner of things did happen.
Like what?
Well, broad daylight violence. I used to have a neighbor who'd chase his girlfriend, wife, with a table leg after he'd been up too long, and broad daylight down the middle of the road, and things like that were happening, petty crime.
So when you saw your neighbor chase his wife with a leg of a table, did you call the police or just let them do their thing?
Yeah. My wife won't let me just stand there if somebody's going after his wife like that. So at one point in like 2 years, we had six domestics that were so close to our front door, we felt required to be the ones to go out and break it up. And that was all happening then, and it hasn't happened again now in some years. So all associated with the burgeoning of meth in the neighborhood.
Deborah, your previous movie was about a woman who's a coke addict. She was played by Vera Farmiga, and she's the mother of two, just as in your new movie, Ree is the older sister of two children, and she's basically bringing them up on her own. So it's a combination of taking care of children and drugs that hold these two movies together, that and the fact that the word bone is in the title of both of them. So tell us why stories where drugs have an impact on a woman taking care of children are stories that you want to tell.
I think in these situations, the stakes are just so high when drug use is an issue and children are present, so that the behaviors of a female who is responsible for children, it's just the pressures to do the right thing are even higher. The responsibilities are even higher. And I think that part of what fuels Ree in Daniel's novel is that Chief does feel the stakes are high for her. It's not just whether she could go out and sort of make her way and escape a bad situation, but that she does feel that she has these two young people that are very much tied to her. Their well-being is completely tied to her. And so I feel like in any novel or film, that responsibility, that existential responsibility, if you will, raises the stakes of what that protagonist is going to do, what choices she will make, what moves she'll make.
Daniel Woodrell, in Esquire magazine in 2007, in the Esquire 100 issue, you were number 63, and your entry was written by Benjamin Percy. And I want to quote what he had to say about your novels. He said, "Pick one up and you'll find blood and hay, barbed wire and whiskey, a Ziploc bag of crank. You'll find barroom brawls and trailer park meth labs, guns, a stripper with peroxide blonde hair. These are books for men." Mm. I think that's kind of funny since, Deborah, you adapted one of his books into a movie and really related to the fact that it had a strong woman character. So, Daniel, let me start with you. Is Ree an unusual character for you? Is it unusual for you to be telling a story from a woman's point of view?
Well, in a way, she's sort of the culmination of or an elaboration on some female characters I've kind of written about all along, usually in smaller roles. But I think I've always included a lot of women in my books, and they're usually pretty potent women. But in this instance, she just was clearly the straw that stirred everything here. And once I started writing on it, she became more and more prominent, and I realized it was basically going to be all her.
And Deborah, does it strike you as funny that in Esquire, Daniel's books were described as books for men, and you so related to this story, you so wanted to tell the story of a strong woman?
Oh, you know, I didn't know about the Esquire label, but I must say that Daniel gets huge props around the world at this point for writing women that women in the audience are enjoying hugely. And I get asked, is the Ozarks a matriarchy, quite frequently, which, you know, I always have to pause and sort of figure out how to answer that.
I don't want to give away too much of the movie, so I'll just say here that there is a scene where a couple of women beat up another woman. And then a man basically wants to know, like, what did it, you know, did a man hit her? And so one of the women says, this is how she says it in the movie. She says, no man hit her. I put the hurt on her. And then in the book, the way she says it is, no man here touched that crazy girl. I drubbed her good myself. So there seems to be almost a code here that, like, bad for a man to hit a woman, okay for a woman to hit a woman. Daniel, is that the code?
Well, I wouldn't say it's code, but I think there might be some ancient perception that that's a fair fight.
Right. Right. Is that why you did it that way?
Yes. Yes. And I have seen a few women brawls that were every bit as nasty as anything I've seen men do. So it definitely happens.
Where did you witness them?
Just in different establishments around my life and places. And one was in the Ramada Inn parking lot, actually one of the most savage I ever saw in broad daylight.
What happened?
A finger got bit off.
And, whoa!
Yeah, and she spit it at the other woman's foot. And I thought, oh, no, I haven't even seen guys do that.
Wow, that sounds that sounds.
Well, they were serious.
Sounds like she had some pretty sharp teeth, among other things.
Yeah, she did. She must have had to break it and gnaw a little to get it off.
Does this help explain why you write the books that you write?
Partially. I mean, most of the Ozarks life is so tranquil and peaceful and easygoing that you have to kind of sometimes look for this part to find it. It's here, but it's not the overwhelming daily experience or anything. But I have, just by luck, or maybe my father said I had a real instinct for finding these things. And so I just have, one way or another, been standing there when enough happened to fill my imagination with what else could happen.
And Deborah, do you have that kind of interest in violence that people who make violent films or write violent novels tend to have?
I can say no. I can say it's another one. It's, you know, if you talk about emotional zip codes, or that's definitely out of my zip code. And I you know, I struggle with that. And what I want to do about human violence in representing it in films, and it's something I always have to put a huge amount of thought to. And take a deep breath, because it doesn't come easy to me to watch it, witness it. I do have one standard. If a person's capable of remorse, I'm already interested, because I do understand that it's complex. So everything in this book seemed to have a very worthy reason to be there in terms of how, when violence does occur between people, I felt like I had an understanding of why.
So, Deborah, how did you start making movies?
I started in kind of documentary fashion and educational filmmaking, training tapes. I worked with trade unions in Massachusetts and actually was responsible for health and safety training films. That meant that I was constantly meeting people that I would never have a reason to cross paths with or would not have access to in their places of employment, with a huge amount of detail of their work life available for me, required of me to film. So it was kind of a strange form of a candy shop for me, because as someone who was documenting as a living, I was given access to places that were endlessly, you know, fascinating to actually film, be it manufacturing sites, be it all forms of employment throughout the state of Massachusetts. And it got me kind of to be the desire to permanently record and take notes on people's lives.
Now, I read that your director of photography, Michael McDonough, helped fund your movie through the money that he got shooting Celebrity Apprentice. So I just think that's kind of funny, you know, that he'd be shooting Celebrity Apprentice and then be shooting this, you know, indie film.
We all have day jobs. I mean, that was his day job, you know. Up until recently, I shot weddings. You know, it's like his day job had him having a paycheck we had the opportunity to option the book, and he came running over after that check was released to him, and we all went in a third for the option. And, you know, that was his way of saying, I don't want to deliberate on this anymore. You know, this is what I want to do. Here's my part of it. You guys put yours in. And so we did.
Daniel, I'm going to ask you to read another page from your novel, Winter's Bone. And in this paragraph, read Dolly, your main character, the 17-year-old who's taking care of her two young siblings, is thinking about and worrying about her siblings' future.
Ree's grand hope was that these boys would not be dead to wander by age 12, dulled to life, empty of kindness, boiling with mean. So many Dolly kids were that way, ruined before they had chin hair, groomed to live outside square law and abide by the remorseless, blood-soaked commandments that governed lives led outside square law. There were 200 Dollies living within 30 miles of this valley. Some lived square lives, many did not, but even the square-living Dollies were Dollies at heart and might be helpful kin in a pinch. The rough Dollies were plenty peppery and hard-boiled toward one another, but were unleashed hell on enemies, scornful of town law and town ways, clinging to their own.
So in your novel, Winter's Bone, Ree, the main character, is considering joining the military. You were in the Marines. Why did you enlist?
I was getting in just a little bit of mischief, and it seemed like the military would be a good idea all the way around. So I went in the week I turned 17, and both my parents thought it was a good idea. So it removed me from the scene for a while.
Yeah, but it sounds like it didn't work out the way you expected.
No, there was trouble to be found there as well, and as my father so often said, I found it. So,
when did you start to write? I presume it was after you got out of the Marines?
That's when I began to more seriously investigate it. It seemed I was always attracted to the idea. I always loved books, and my mother made sure I knew how to read before I went off to school, and I knew pretty early on that I'd like to be a writer if it was possible. It didn't really seem possible, and it was after. It really wasn't until my early 20s that I really decided to dedicate myself to it full tilt and see if, in fact, you had the ability to do it.
How did you figure out what you were going to write about?
For a long time, I wrote stories about working-class life, and I had a professor say, you know, that's always going to be hard when you just do straightforward kind of kitchen-sink realism. And as I let that sink in for a couple of years, I began to realize there were other kinds of fiction I also liked that could almost blend. They almost they complemented each other, really.
Who are you thinking
social,
of?
Well, social realist fiction and crime fiction have a nice overlap. So I was turned on by all the writers in the canon, but I was also always turned on by James M. Cain and Chandler and Thompson and all the others.
A lot of book critics in their reviews have mentioned that you should be better known than you are. It's kind of like a common refrain about you.
Yes.
I'm sure you've heard that song sung a lot. So, you know, it often works that once a movie's made, if it's adapted from a book, the author of that book becomes a lot better known. Are you hoping for that with this movie?
I think it's unavoidable now, so I've decided to hope for it.
Well, I hope you get it.
Right. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us. Deborah Granick, congratulations on your new film, Winter's Bone, which is adapted from my other guest, Daniel Woodrell's novel of the same name. Thanks very much to you both.
Oh, thank you so much. Enjoyed
it. Thank you.
You can read an excerpt of Winter's Bone and see clips from the new movie Winter's Bone on our website, freshair.npr.org. Well, I'm going to be out for a couple of days, which sadly makes today my final day working with Fresh Air producer Jonathan Minhivar, who also produces Fresh Air Weekend. Not to make you feel guilty, Jonathan, but your leaving is a big loss. I'm sure I can speak for all of us on our show when I say I'm going to miss Jonathan as a great producer and as a great person. He's made my interviews better with his insightful editing and listening to the terrific opening billboard Jonathan creates each Friday for Fresh Air Weekend has been a highlight of my week. It's been great to collaborate with him and through that collaboration to get to know him. We've watched Jonathan get married, move into a new home, and just a few months ago become a father. And now we're watching him prepare for his new job as a producer at This American Life, which is particularly great for him because that's the show that made him want to get into public radio. We don't need to tell Ira Glass how lucky he is to have Jonathan. It was Ira who told us about 5 years ago how smart we'd be to hire Jonathan. Jonathan, we know you'll be busy with a new job and a new baby, but please make sure you have time to stay in touch with your friends at Fresh Air, who will miss you immensely. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.